This is an RNZ podcast.
Kia ora, great to be back with you for Country Life. I'm Sally Round.
And I'm Duncan Smith. Hello. It's been another hot week on the land. We'll be hearing how farmers, crops and animals are getting along shortly in our regional wrap.
In today's feature, plums are on the menu, and we also hear about a farmer with more than a sideline brewing beer.
In our 90s file, we meet a woman in her 20s who studied agriculture but had no idea the job she's now doing existed.
But first, we head to the Adelaide Hills in South Australia to speak to this week's guest.
My name is James Tilbrook. We have a winery, vineyard and cellar door in the Lenswood area, which is a sub-region of the Adelaide Hills. The winery there is called Tilbrook Estate, and we've got around about 10 acres of vines, mainly Chardonnay and Pinot Noir, and then we've also got a bit of Sauv Blanc and a bit of Pinot Gris.
On the 20th of December last year, James saw his 21-year-old vineyard go up in smoke. About one-third of the Adelaide Hills vineyard region stood in the path of one of the massive, fatal bushfires, which have burnt more than 10 million hectares across the country. After the fire, James returned to find utter devastation, buildings burnt to the ground, equipment ruined, and the vineyard scorched.
Stringer posts were burnt to the ground, intermediate posts, wooden posts were burnt to the ground, vines were all sort of brown-looking. Some of them were sort of black. The rest of the place was really black. The air was full of smoke. The ground was just black pretty much everywhere. There was a little bit of hope, I suppose, in the fact that there was a little bit of green vine still remaining, but most of it looked like, at that moment in time, looked like I'd lost most of it.
Is it possible for those vines to recover?
The issue that we've got is that most of our vineyard is planted on rootstock, so we have got a little bit of vines that are planted on their own roots. Those own roots can basically regenerate from below ground, and so some of those ones that were really badly damaged are starting to grow from below ground. But with the rootstock vines, the graft is above ground, it's about a foot above ground, so if it's been burnt badly in there and the ground, those vines are basically dead. We have had viticultural students from the University of Adelaide come up and do fairly comprehensive testing for us. There's a thing that they can do, which is to test the cambium layer. That's a sort of green layer just underneath the bark. If it's there, then the vine's going to survive. If it's not, it won't. So what we've found is that those vines that were closest to the areas of greatest devastation, they are ones that we're going to have to replant. Once you get further away from that and there's less heat intensity and so on, what we've actually done is we've gone through with the help of a lot of volunteers and we've cut off the branches off the vines and just to leave the trunk. And a lot of that is shooting from the top, and it's just absolutely fantastic to see, because it's sort of, you know, from 6 weeks ago when I thought I'd lost pretty much the lot, to realise that, in fact, we may well be able to save something like 70 or 80% of the vineyard is just fills you with such hope.
That's fantastic news. And how is the rest of the vineyard community coping?
You've got people who've got a sort of varying levels of devastation. You've got people who've got completely black vines, which are pretty well dead. You've got ones that are sort of brown all the way from the bottom of the trunk right to the top of the tip of the highest shoot. Those vines, if they do regenerate like ours, will probably take 2 years before they bear a crop. You've then got ones where the heat has kind of just been fairly minimal, but enough to kind of singe the bottom third or two-thirds of the vine. So the top of the vine is still green, but the bottom third or two-thirds is singed. They will have lost their crop for this year, and hopefully they'll be able to get a crop next year. And then you've got people who've got totally green vineyards or parts of vineyards which potentially could produce crop this year. But the biggest problem for those guys, and it's just really a question of uncertainty because nobody has come back and sort of said we know for sure whether this is going to be a problem or not, is smoke taint, which of course means that they won't be able to sell their grapes. And that's a huge impact on the rest of the region. I mean, it's people's livelihoods we're talking about.
And how is the community coping psychologically?
Well, the people I talk to are generally positive people. I mean, farmers generally are positive people. You know, we have to deal with, you know, rain, hail, drought, sunshine. I mean, as a result, you know, we do tend to be a resilient bunch. We do tend to be sort of fairly positive about things. But, of course, you can understand if you've got a 40-acre vineyard, for example, like a friend of mine has, and they've lost their entire crop, that's hundreds of thousands of dollars worth. And how do you recover from that? It's a huge hit to the bottom line. So people do look sort of positive on the outside, I think, but there's a lot of people who deep down inside are hurting.
James Tilbrook. And James says the area is calling for volunteers to help vineyard owners and farmers get back on their feet and for people to keep visiting and buying the local wines in order to keep the local economy going. He's relabeled some of his surviving wine Hope.
And now to our look at conditions on the land. The dry weather in Northland continues. Dams are at low levels and farmers are wondering where the next bit of feed will come from. The consultant we speak to says he knows of one farmer who was called by a grazier to be told he's out of feed and the farmer needs to take his young stock back. He says because the payout's good and there's still a lot of season to run, it's worth spending money to keep cows well fed, watered and milking. There's a bottleneck at the works and he advises farmers to book space now for a month down the track rather than wait until pregnancy testing is done. Apart from more cloud and a little mist, it's still dry in the vegetable growing area around Pukekohe. Onion growers are not complaining as the mature crops are steadily being binned and removed from fields to the storage sheds. For everything else, if crops are not being irrigated, they won't be growing.
The export avocado season's about 80% through, and Bay of Plenty growers have been delivering good quality fruit. In Australia, the fires have interrupted the delivery of their own avocados, so New Zealand avocados have the market a little more to themselves. Returns are good. Some of the fruit's heading to India, where the fruit fetches very good prices. Thailand and Korea also pay well. Waikato is becoming very dry and farms on clay soils are in the worst shape of all. Farmers are in drought management mode, which involves changing milking intervals if they haven't already, scanning and getting rid of empties and rationing supplements. Maize crops are 4 to 8 weeks away from harvest. Farmers are feeling very thankful for palm kernel.
King Country had nice drizzle on Thursday. The region is drying out, though, and work space is tight. We're told they're not taking ewes and space for lambs is limited. It hasn't helped that there have been a lot of short weeks since Christmas. Where there is grass cover, farms are still looking green, but anything that's been chewed out hasn't come away. It's been hot and sunny in Taranaki, and farmers have put in an order for 20 millimetres of rain and then another 20, please, in a week's time. Farmers have been feeding out silage and are moving to 3 milkings in 2 days. They'll be once a day before too long if rain doesn't arrive. A South Taranaki farmer says this January has been the 10th driest month since he started keeping records 55 years ago.
In Hawke's Bay, it's hot, 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 dry and very windy. There have been a string of days in the mid-30s. The grape season's running a week to 10 days ahead of normal and Veraison has hit at the same time on early and late varieties. Growers are frantically trying to take care of all the work they need to do, which is usually spread over a couple of weeks, but now needs to be done at once. On farm, everyone's waiting for rain. Some hills have gone grey and pastures are starting to burn out. In general, though, stock are being well fed and are in good condition. Manawatu's had a bizarre season. The whole region's extremely dry. Usually there's rain in December, but that didn't come, so it wasn't well set up for summer. However, Manawatu hasn't had its usual January heat, so that's been a bit of a saviour. A lot of lambs are still running around the hills. The store market has dropped. Farmers here are struggling to get cattle to the works. They leave the farm first because they eat more than sheep. Some crops, like peas and hemp, are being harvested a month early because of the lack of moisture.
Horowhenua has been much cooler than a lot of other parts of the country. You even need a sweatshirt in the mornings. It's still green and there's been rain this week, 20 to 30 millimetres in the foothills and up to 7 near the coast. Cows are going okay, milk production slightly behind or on par with last year. Wairarapa farmers are starting to plan for a prolonged dry period. Irrigators are going flat out. Some people are looking to send their ewes away for grazing to Woodville or Paiatua, where there's still feed. It's been great weather for harvesting arable crops.
Across the Cook Strait, an apple grower in Motueka is preparing to start harvesting the new Posy apple, an early variety cross between Pacific Rose and Royal Gala. Thinning's almost finished on the orchard and a bit of summer pruning's going on. The Nelson region could do with some rain though, and some areas like the Waimea Plains are under expanded water restrictions. The coronavirus situation in China is keeping fruit growers on tenterhooks, wondering how the disease will affect such an important export market for New Zealand.
It's been hot, dry and very windy in Marlborough, as is normal for this time of year. Our contact says he's busy ensuring shade and water for stock in the 30 to 34 degree heat. The feed situation is still good because of really good spring rain. While it may look brown and unappetising, the feed is there and of good quality. But a possible water shortage is looming if there is no significant rain soon. Our farmer says you've got to have backup if you're reliant on the Southern Valley's irrigation scheme, as that's likely to be shut off in the next fortnight. The vineyards are still going through veraison or onset of ripening as critical spraying for disease like powdery mildew continues.
A dairy farmer at Lake Brunner on the west coast says they had some welcome rain on Friday after more than 2 weeks of fine, dry weather. His cows are producing well. He's catching up on his maintenance, weed spraying and fencing, and a little bit of hay and silage is being made. It's been another hot, dry week in Canterbury. Feed on dry land properties is disappearing fast. Where farmers have it, irrigation systems are running flat out to try and keep soil moisture levels up. Arable farmers have begun harvest on grass seed crops and early sown cereal crops, and results so far look promising. Fibre hemp crops are currently being cut and left in the field for drying.
A wee bit of rain this week in Otago was pretty much cancelled out by strong winds, and more rain is needed. A dairy farmer in the Tairi Basin is still okay for feed, being on a floodplain, but he understands others are struggling. He's getting ready for the next round of pregnancy testing and making a bit of baleage. Farmers faced with falling land prices are feeling extra stress with banks looking to claw back debt. Strong dry winds in Southland have been sucking up moisture, although a good 8 millimetres of rain this week helped the area from becoming too parched. Feed is tightening up and a decent shower would be welcome. Our farmer says he's been sorting lambs for the works, which are all tight for space. The lamb schedule has come back over the past few weeks and is expected to tighten further. Farmers here too are wondering what effect the coronavirus will have on their export markets.
You're listening to Country Life on RNZ National, 101 FM.
Time now for the 90s file, where we introduce you to people born in the 90s who've chosen to work in agriculture, hort or in agribusiness. We often hear about the opportunities available in farming-related businesses and about the shortage of young people who want to work in the sector. This week, we're in Hamilton.
Hi, I'm Bri Loveridge and I was born in 1996. I grew up on a dairy farm in the Taranaki and then moved to the Waikato when I was all of 6 or 7.
What do you do for a job?
So I work for a company called Lely. It's an international company that does automatic robotic milking. So I'm a farm management advisor for them. I look after New Zealand with a few other people. We've got 18 farms throughout New Zealand, so 90 robots throughout the whole of New Zealand. The cow freely milks and freely moves throughout the farm. Yeah, so we help assist them in their everyday practices, help them understand all the data that they can extract from it, and just provide management solutions to actually optimise their business and reach their goals on their farms.
So there are 18 farms in New Zealand with robotic milking machines, and there are 90 of these robots.
Yes, that's correct, yeah.
So you have a couple on each farm, do you?
Yeah, so we've got a farm with just one, but we've also got a farm with 16 of them on. Which is pretty incredible. We probably average about 4 robots per robotic farm. A robot is an automated milking machine, so the cow walks in, the cups attach to the cow, milks her, and then there's a little bit of feeds dispensed, and she's let go, and directed to the pasture where she's supposed to be going.
Did you go to university?
Yes, I did. I went to Massey University in Palmerston North, studied a Bachelor of Agri-Commerce, majoring in farm management.
Do you like your job?
Yeah, I love it. I love it.
Yeah, what do you like about it?
I love my customers. They're passionate about the dairy farming, and you see the change in lifestyle. That's one of the main goals of these farms when they put them in, is to change their lifestyle so that they can get off farm a bit more, spend more time with their family and their kids, and they're all achieving that. So that's just awesome to see. You know, they're not having to rush back to milk cows at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. They can carry on and watch kids' sports. I've been pretty privileged to be able to travel the world with this job. I've been in the job just over a year now. I've been to Netherlands, Ireland, Denmark, go to Australia quite often. So I've seen a lot of different farms around the world so far.
When you were at university, what options did you have when you were looking for a career?
I just started looking at the everyday places, LIC, FMG, just becoming like a farm advisor, banker, anything like that, a fertiliser rep. I never knew this sort of option was available until I kind of heard about it and applied for it and got it, and it's incredible. It's amazing the opportunities that are actually out there in the industry.
So what skills do you get to use in your job?
I get to use my personality skills. I love talking. I love talking to people. I love communicating with farmers. Or just being me as well. I can go up to a farmer and feel really confident and bubbly and gaining their respect. I just love the challenges as well. Being a female in this industry can be quite hard too, because you get people commenting and say, do you find it difficult dealing with males? And it is true, you do come across those ones, but it's a challenge and I love challenges.
Where do you see your career going?
Maybe in the long run, I want to own my own business. I love what I'm doing right now, so it's hard to say where I'm going to be in 5 years, but I think my long-term goal is to own my own business in something like farm consultancy, because I love, you know, dealing with farmers and working with people.
How much time do you get to spend out of the office?
I get to spend quite a lot, actually. Probably about 70% I'm on outside of the office, which is quite cool, whether I'm on the road, travelling, seeing a bit more of the world, or seeing clients. It varies week to week, which is another reason why I love my job. No day is the same for me, so yeah.
Briar Loveridge, who works for Layli. She says some cows choose to be milked 3 times a day and others just stroll up to the robot once.
And next, Sally is off to a farm not far from the northern shores of Lake Thobor. But things are not quite as they seem.
Rolling green pasture, a herd of cows quietly munching, fat lambs skipping about. But hang on a minute, this is no ordinary sheep and beef farm. There's a yellow warning sign on the gate, and it seems like a big hairy beast is on the loose, and he's carrying what looks like a bottle of beer. I head up to the farm shed to find out what's going on.
Hi, I'm James Cooper. Here at Lakeman Brewing with Kenny and Rory, our chief brewers, and today we're making Tobal Thunder.
James Cooper finishes lambs and runs a herd of Simmental cattle on a 120-hectare property north of Lake Thobor. He branched out into beer 7 years ago and runs a craft brewery on the farm too. That's where the hairy monster comes in. Lakeman is the beer's label. James divides his time between the brewery and the farm. Today, he's showing me around before heading off to a lamb sale.
This was originally an implement shed when we first came. It had no concrete on the ground. It was all bare dirt. And we put some concrete in there, a drain in the middle, and moved the brewery in and went from there. So over here, right now, Rory's mashing in. He's making Tobal Thunder, our local beer, pale ale.
Rory Donovan is Lakeman's chief brewer.
Talk us through what mashing in is.
Mashing in is very simply mixing milled grain with hot water at a very specific temperature to convert the sugars inside the grain into a usable format for the yeast later on in the process.
Can we go up there and have a look?
We can indeed.
So we're basically mixing the water and grain together, getting it soaking. Yeah. Unfortunately, we are manual, not mechanical. True hands-on. It's the workout for the morning.
It's a real workout, isn't it? You're really pushing that long pole.
Just a rake.
Oh, it's a rake. It's a garden rake.
Yeah. It's just like making porridge, just on a bigger scale.
And how long do you have to do that for?
It takes about 20, 25 minutes, and then it's full mashing.
And is that your beautiful spring water?
Yep, so the water is actually bore water. It's located 70 metres below the shed.
And now what are you doing there? You've got a temperature gauge?
Just measuring the temperature, just making sure that we have the correct mash temperature here. Yeah. So, well, aiming for about that, 68, 68 and a half.
So it's looking good?
Yep.
Most of our hops are Kiwi hops, and they come from Nelson down south. But we do use quite a few American hops, which obviously we have to import, but they all come through New Zealand Hops, which is, at the moment, probably the biggest hop company in New Zealand.
So why are you using American hops?
So different varieties have different properties to them, obviously different flavour profiles, different alpha acids for bittering and things like that. So it's important to sort of sample the whole range and obviously diversify all the flavours that we can get. We're big fans of citrus flavours in a lot of them. Obviously, most of our citrus flavours do come from the hops themselves. Like, in only two or three of the beers that we've made, we've actually added citrus zest to them to give them a little bit of extra punch. But we can achieve quite a few flavours through hop use only. So, like, stone fruit, tropical. Some get a little bit of a pineapple-y, berry sort of flavour as well. It's just, it's so much range in the hop profiles these days. So
this is the pump shed, so this is where the water comes out below here. Turn it on. You can see it's crystal clear.
The other prime ingredient is the spring water, which runs under the farm, naturally filtered through layers of topo pumice.
The water obviously is very clean tasting, and there's no hardiness to it or anything like that. It's just a very neutral water. Like BP and McDonald's try to get their water to that level before they go into the coffee machines.
We're back in the brewery.
So yeah, we're back in the brewery, and this is our wonderful bottling machine. There's a bit of a time machine. She's an old beast, but
it's quite a contraption, isn't it?
It is. Yeah, it's. It's a little bit good. It ticks along. It does about 1,200 bottles an hour for us. We only does 330s. Occasionally we do 500s. But with canning now coming in, we do can some beer, but we get people to come in and can that, yeah.
Any bottling happening today?
No. Sale day today, so, yeah.
Lamb sale day.
Yeah.
So how did the brewery come about?
We leased a lot of land, and we were losing land, but at least land at a time. And we'd bought this place, and we felt that we needed something else for the future, just in case we lost more land and leased land and things like that, just to give us another income and a bit of security for the going forward in the future. We were capped as how much livestock we could carry in the Lake Taupo catchment, and that gave us the opportunity, A, to buy them because of the uncertainty. Yeah, and we happened to be in Australia at the same time, and that's like when the light bulb moment came off, because I drank a bottle of Cooper's, a beer which has been around for many generations in Australia. And last name was Cooper, and it was a family-run business. And so, yeah, it's like, well, hey, why can't we do that here?
How difficult was it from there to getting the brewery actually started up?
Getting it started up is good, but probably learning the processes and things like that has been the hardest. We're lucky we've got a great team now too, but, yeah, that was probably the hardest part. And now was probably, you know, trying to get market. It's probably selling it. It's easy to make anything, but selling it's the hard part. Yeah. To me, it's a lot of it is about the challenge of making great beer. It's a bit like farming. It's hard to reach perfection because there's always unknowns coming to you, whether it be drought or relating a bit to farming or changing the grain or.
And how much time do you spend on the beer compared to the lambs and the?
To be fair, probably about 95% in the brewery. We're lucky with a great guy. We've had great people on the farm. It's just a lot of bottling and cleaning a little bit down there, things like that. Selling, just doing those sorts of things. Yeah, it is a big. It is a bit of a beast, I suppose you'd say, yeah.
And talking about a beast, I mean, you've used this sort of branding, this logo of this rather hairy, big, monster-looking icon as your brand.
Oh, we just,
where did that come from?
A little bit to do with the Loch Ness Monster, but we just wanted something for Taupo, I suppose. When we sat down to do the branding and making the name up, Alyssa came up with the name Lake Man, and we just wanted a character to go with it that we could have a bit of fun with along the way. And he just happened to be a big, hairy beast. And, yeah, that's how it all came about, yeah. Yeah.
And you said before it's getting that beer to market, that's the tricky part.
Yeah, I mean, we're stuck on a farm in Taupo, so it's harder. We haven't got population around us. I mean, if you're in a city, it's easier to get word of mouth spread quicker, whereas here we've got to work a hell of a lot harder to get our beer to other centres.
James' wife, Alyssa, a vet, is also involved with the business after initially being very sceptical of the idea of a brewery on the farm.
I remember the night he told me, I was like we were going to bed, and I could see him reading a book on brewing. I was like, oh, what are you doing? And he said, oh, I'm going to start a brewery. And I just went, oh my God. And I just remember just rolling over in bed going, we're doomed. Honestly, it wasn't good.
And 7 years down the line, what's your thinking now?
It's been some really good highs and some lows, but really proud of sort of we've created it literally from nothing, and it's neat to see the beers out there nationally now and winning some awards and employing a few local people. That's really neat too.
James says it's also been a learning curve for the two brewery workers who are pretty much thrown into their jobs.
Rory's had a line of brothers that all worked here. He was basically working on the bottling line, and we had a brewer left. And I said, right, you're going to be head brewer now. And since he's been there, won a lot of awards. So I gave him an 8-week crash course on it. Then we just put him through a diploma. And then Kenny used to work, used to sell our beer in town. And he loved the beer so much that he came out here to brew it.
Yeah, I've done a little bit of experience over in Australia with breweries. So thought it was time for a career change. Got out of being the bartender and come to make this stuff. See, it's a very hands-on brewery, this one, so I've learnt the Lake Man way. It's been pretty good ever since, and we've picked up a few gold medals and champions trophies. And
what are you doing now? You've hitched up a hose here.
Yeah, I'm just about to filter a beer. So after the beer's been in the fermentation process and it's finished fermenting, it goes through a series of filters, and that turns the beer from cloudy to very clear and drinkable product.
Okay, so we're just checking the pH level of the mash, or wort as it's called, and just making sure that it's within the right levels so that we're getting the appropriate bitterness. But it's just, we sent some beer away to the awards recently, and so they're always a good sort of indicator. We get a lot of feedback from them, so we can adjust from there. We're constantly tweaking the beers, but it just gives us more direction. The previous job I had before this was literally driving tractors for a contractor doing the silage season, and you get pretty burnt out doing that. But then my brother was working here, helping James with the bottling and the packaging, and he said, come down and give us a hand, and so I did. And then one day soon they said, do you want to learn how to brew? And obviously you want to better yourself in any way you can. So I said, yeah, and here we are. It's been just learning on the job and doing a little bit of background as well, with theory. It's definitely become less a job, more a vocation. It has been sort of unreal, just the disconnect of, obviously when I first started I was just putting bottles in boxes and they were getting shipped out to God knows where, and then you actually go to a bar, you see someone draw up a beer of Lakeman, and it's awesome. It's just a payoff for the work that we do.
Rory Donovan, a brewer at Lakeman Brewery. You also heard from fellow brewer Kenny Rivers and James and Alyssa Cooper.
Hi, I'm Clint Meyer from Fire Dragon Chilies in the far north, and you're listening to Country Life on RNZ National.
In today's feature, Carol's in Hawke's Bay in a golf cart.
You see how big these are going to get?
We're going to be too big.
No. Well, we've got a hell of a crop on them this year. Look at the growth the trees are making. These are Angelino, dark-skinned.
But yellow flesh.
Yellow flesh, delightful fruits for the fruit bowl.
And a good size, not too big.
Yep.
Perfect size.
Julian Mike Russell's plum orchard is one of New Zealand's largest. Together they grow 13,000 plum trees not far from Hastings. They grow almost a dozen varieties. Some they are about to introduce to us, others that are tried and true.
On the right here we've got Black Doris trees, which are probably 15 to 16 years of age, hopefully giving us somewhere around 70 to 80 kilograms of fruit per tree, which equates to 50 to 60 tonne per hectare. These are all Black Doris destined for Waddies in Hastings to be canned. And I think if you ask anybody our age to name two plums, I'll guarantee Black Doris is one that they'll come up with.
In the past few years, New Zealand growers have produced just over 2.5 million kilograms of plums a year, and they all come off the trees in summer.
We pick the fruit as close to being ready to be consumed as possible, bearing in mind that if we pick on a Monday and then it's packed, then it's refrigerated and transported to the markets all over New Zealand, and that fruit picked on the Monday is on the shop shelves by Thursday or Friday. That's the best case scenario. So if we're waiting for the fruit to actually drop off the tree to be absolutely tree ripened, it's not going to last that week and then hopefully another 4 or 5 days in the end consumer's fruit bowl. We don't have the brown rot issues with plums that some other summer fruit species, varieties, nectarines, peaches, apricots, for example. Not sure why that is. There may be some inherent resistance to brown rot. But if we look after them well and store them well and keep the cool chain efficient, then we should have pretty good fruit in the supermarket shelves and in the shops.
That one that you've got in your hand there, it's almost black, isn't it?
If I put my knife through that, that's a pretty exceptional looking piece of fruit.
You wouldn't want to be wearing white jeans, would you?
I don't wear white jeans very often in the orchard. But you can try that if you'd like.
And lean out of the of the cart.
Very distinctive taste, Black Doris. Like Amiga, they're very distinctive plums, and they're the two plums that most people of our age, of my age, relate to, is Omega and Black Doris.
They taste like a plum should.
They do taste like a plum should, you're quite right. But we're allowed to try different things with plums too.
What Summerfruit New Zealand and United Fresh and some individual growers are doing now is actually researching the antioxidant and anthocyanin values of this dark red-fleshed fruit, and it's looking pretty positive. It's got all the goodies that we need. There's boysenberries and black currants, and the blueberry people have done a wonderful marketing job with their product. And there's a lot of us believe that Black Doris or red flesh plums have got very similar health attributes. And that's what we have to start researching, that we can back that up with some hard facts and marketing it along those lines.
Plums aren't the only things Mike and Julie have grown. The green-fingered couple met studying horticulture at Massey University, and since then they've gone on to grow apples, peaches, golden queens for Watties, and other processed crops like asparagus, sweet corn, tomatoes and dwarf beans. And they've grown flowers. In recent years, the Russells have mainly settled on plums, which are sent to the fresh market and to Watties for canning whole and for jams. Julie and Mike also grow 50 tonnes of peacherines. They grow pumpkins, a bit of maize, and lease land to Watties for growing. They fatten sheep on the cropped land in winter and tend a spectacular garden.
You know, we've been growing and growing together for probably since before we were married, close to 40 years, loving it.
It's a fabulous place to grow, Hawke's Bay, and we have a marvellous climate. And we also have a fair bit of risks with hail and frost and everything else. But, hey, it keeps us going. It keeps us young.
Have you ever been wiped out or had terrible hail damage?
Yes. The worst one was in 1994, which absolutely decimated us and I think about 40% of the Hawke's Bay apple crop. It struck at
20 past 11 on the 2nd of March 1994.
Still very memorable, even though so long ago, it'll never ever be forgotten.
25 years ago, it was pretty devastating. I mean, Hawke's Bay is a fruit-growing region, and when you get hit really as badly as we did back in 94, it affected the entire community.
What were you doing on that day?
I was actually picking flowers. We were preparing for a big centenary of one of the schools here, and we had a huge crop of sunflowers that we were just about to pick, and we were actually just about to pick all our fruit. It was the beginning of our season. We had peaches ready to pick, apples, and these wonderful flowers and delphiniums, and it just, this black cloud came into this blue sky, and the change of temperature was immediate, and it was just so frightening watching it. It just didn't stop. It just went on and on and on. And not only the fruit were completely damaged, but the trees had big pit marks in them. So it took longer than a year to recover from. It was devastating for so many people. But it takes a lot to get your confidence back after you have such a hit, because no income for 18 months. And also, yeah, it's the confidence to actually keep going and think, well, this year, next year, it won't happen again, because sometimes it does.
But on the other side of the coin, Carol, there's so much pleasure in seeing a bin of full fruit. And as we move down, you'll hear some of the... We've got a lot of RSEs picking today, Samoan people, fabulous workers. They're singing, they're having a good time. We're seeing some good fruit go out of the orchard. We're seeing good packouts from the packhouse. We're receiving reasonable returns for the product in the markets in New Zealand.
And it's exciting. When you have a season like this and things go well, it lasts you for a few years. When things are not going so well, you just go back and remember how good it can be. And at the moment, cross our fingers, it's good so far.
These are a new variety here called Flavour Blast. Very sweet. These trees have only been in the ground 18 months. And they'll probably come off next week. But this is the first commercial crop of this variety harvested in New Zealand. Right. Craig's our manager, and he's pretty busy this time of the year, running around. How many people today? 23, Craig?
24, yeah. 24.
Right, so what are they working on today?
We're working on Primetime and Fortune today.
Primetime as a variety, is it?
Yes. Yep, that's our first variety right there, yeah.
Quite a big, robust piece of fruit.
Now, that's the size of a billiard ball.
Yeah, that's an average sort of size. We've got some smaller ones in here. We had a lot of big fruit last year and had 4 inches of rain in the middle of harvest, and we had a massive loss of fruit because the fruit just split. It was too big.
We have Fortune here, which we've done our pick for market, for dessert. And now this is just all jam, so it's going into Waddy's bins like this.
Waddy's are buying fibre and sugar when they buy this product, and I'll open one up. It's great eating, a little bit rough on the skin, but it makes a very good mix of yellow fleshed with a slight red fleck through it, and it processes very well. And they'll mix this with a black variety, i.e. Black Doris or Omega, and they'll get their jam blends out of that.
Now, you've had a long relationship with Waddy's.
Yeah, I've been going into the Waddy's factory in King Street since I was 12, so I've been doing it for 50 years. Fabulous company. A lot of different owners over the years, but it's still in King Street and it's still the same bricks and mortar, and even some of the people are still the same. But Waddy's is a huge part of the Hawke's Bay economy.
And what percentage of your fruit would they take?
They'll take about 100 tonne of Black Doris, which will be about 15 or 16, maybe 18% of our total yield this year.
And how much of your total yield goes into supermarkets, grocery stores?
We only export less than 2%. We're still trying to break into that. So it's basically the process for Waddy's, and the balance all goes into the New Zealand domestic market. We tag, from a traceability point of view, we tag each individual block, and we know who picked it. So if there's any recall in the days to come, we can trace it back to the block, to the spray program, to the picker, and it's what the supermarkets and the consumers are now asking for, is entire traceability, not dissimilar to the red meat sector.
Mike says a good picker will pick 400 300-kilogram bins a day, sometimes a bit more.
We pay all our staff on hourly rate. The rate is set by the contractor. I'm pretty sure in saying that it's all above the New Zealand living wage, so well above minimum. The reason we don't go onto contract is because we're picking selectively, we're grazing the orchard, some varieties four and five times, and it's all about the quality of the fruit. I'd much rather pay more per kilogram to get it picked and get it picked right rather than to get a cheaper product. It would be penny-wise and very pound-foolish to have pickers stripping the trees off and ruining our fruit. It's only taken us 11 and a half months to get to this stage, so we're not going to cut costs here or try and be penny-pinching over the harvest. We've got an interesting variety here called Autumn Honey. It's a new intellectual property or IP variety. Some people call it dinosaur egg, hence the as a result of the shape of it.
Do New Zealanders still like plums?
More and more so. And I think that's because the markets are becoming more discerning. We're presenting to the market, and I mean we as the industry, the whole summer fruit industry, is presenting better fruit, ready to eat, better varieties, harvested at an opportune time, and it's giving the end consumer a good experience, a good eating experience.
And also, Mike, we start in early December, and actually plums are still being picked and eaten at the end of March. So there's a very complete season now, and there's been a lot of work going to extending the plum eating season and the plum growing season. So the new varieties that are coming out are fabulous, the later plums, as well as the early plums. So if you start eating plums and you love plums, well, you've got 5 months ahead of you.
Yeah, we've got 11 different varieties on the property here. We tend to try and plant our different varieties now so that we go from one to the other to the other to hold our shelf space. So there is quite exciting things. Far too many varieties for the supermarkets to actually name them all and sell them by their name, but they'll often be sold as black-skinned yellow flesh or black-skinned red flesh.
What colour are the blossoms? Are they white?
All white, yes.
It is beautiful.
It must look beautiful. A real picture in here.
It does, but there is the pink is the peacherines, and they're beautiful too. I love pink blossom. It's beautiful.
And plums need different varieties to pollinate them. So we introduce about 20 honeybee beehives, and we also introduce some boxes of bumblebees to do the job. Bumblebees are fabulous little animals. They'll work in much cooler, windier and even damper condition than honeybees. But they collect the pollen from the different varieties and then they rub that and they basically cross-pollinate the flower, and that's how you get a crop. Whereas the peacherines down here are self-fertile. They'll do their own thing all on their own. With bees, but you don't need other varieties. Wet weather at Blossom is one of the worst things. We're always working with the climate. We don't like frosts, we don't like hail, and sometimes we don't like rain, and sometimes we do.
Hey, lady!
Sherry? How are you?
Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm Carol.
I've just been to take my choice pick to my car.
Good for you. Okay, so you're just getting the very best for you. Why not? You're allowed to.
So who are you working with today?
I've got 12 Samoan boys, RS workers.
Yep.
And they're good. Some of them we've had before. Some of them are new. But they're all good.
I hear they sometimes sing in the orchard, do they?
Oh, yeah. It's beautiful. Beautiful.
And laugh.
Yeah, yeah.
Laugh. We can hear it up at the house.
Yeah. And one day they were singing, and I said to them, oh, you're choir boys. They just smiled. I said, yeah, I thought so, because the singing was so good, you know. I was sitting on the bin, just sitting there listening to them. It's good, because they're up the top of the tree, and you can hear them all over the orchard.
And are you picking yourself, or are you just sort of overseeing?
I prefer to pick, because it's not boring. QC is good work, but...
She's our quality controller. Yeah. And
she'd rather pick. She feels she's more valuable that way, but you're more valuable QC, Sherry.
Yes, I know.
And you've got
I know.
Good command, you're in control, and that's what's the most important thing.
When yeah, no, it's great.
You do what Sherry tells you to do, even I do.
So do I.
There's always something to do here, always something to do.
And Sherry helps in the garden too. You can't have a garden like this, and she's been with us for many years in the garden as well, so she's very versatile.
Quick.
She's very, very important in this operation.
And what's your favourite plum?
My favourite plum would be probably the Meagre.
We're all the same. What's the matter with us?
Yeah.
All these lovely new varieties.
Yeah,
we've
yeah.
just got to actually keep plugging them, Sherry.
Yep.
Because we just don't know them as well. That's
no.
the problem.
No.
Every second year, Julie organises the Wildflower Sculpture Exhibition as a fundraiser for Hastings Cranford Hospice. The Russells have 4 hectares of garden, or 10 acres.
Really, there's 2.5 acres that is intensively gardened, and the rest of it is trees, and then down the centre of the triangle paddock, in the summer, this is where the wildflowers are. There's a whole paddock of wildflowers, and it is quite spectacular, mainly with red poppies, but we also grow a lot of other varieties. So that's really what people love to come and see, is those beautiful wildflowers that are early in November, and then the garden as well, and the sculpture, which is right throughout the gardens. So it is quite fabulous. We have about 70 artists, sculptors, who come onto the property and bring their beautiful artwork, and we run it over 5 days, and people can come and buy the sculpture and look at the garden, and we have different activities going on for the 5 days, and it is a fabulous experience. We have a lot of people who come back and help us every 2 years. It's a huge business to run over that 5 days, and we have 6,000 or 7,000 people come into the garden, enjoy the sculpture and enjoy the garden. It takes us a year to prepare for it. Our daughter Our daughter's very involved with it as well, one of our daughters, and she's very involved with the artists. So it's a very interesting area, to a bit of diversity.
And at the end of it all, do you get to give a nice big cheque away?
Last time we gave $100,000 to Cranford, and also what happens is the artists are the ones that I think $160,000 went into the art community. So it's very good for Cranford, but it's very good for our art community, and I think sometimes that is the bit that's forgotten, that artists sell a huge amount of their work. We have a range of work here, and we certainly enjoy it when these artists do very well, which they do, a lot of them.
Is this your first time here? Is this have you been back?
Oh, this is my first time.
How is it?
It's just nice.
How long will you be here?
Just only 1 month.
Only a month?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, how old are you?
28. Yeah.
And what do you do at home?
Nothing.
How many years have you been to New Zealand working?
28.
This is your 8th year?
Yeah.
Wow. And do you come to the Hawke's Bay every time?
Yep. Hawke's Bay and South Island, the spring.
How long are you away from home every year?
7 months.
That's a long time to be away from home.
Yeah. It's for me, that's really good. It's really good for helping in family, in some.
I think people reach for a peach or a nectarine ahead of a plum.
There are a lot more peaches and nectarines sold in New Zealand than there are plums. I don't consider that as plum growers we are competing with peaches and nectarines. We're competing with Mars bars and chippies.
Because I'm a plum grower, I of course always reach for a plum. But there's some fabulous other varieties around, and I'm just hopeful that people will reach for both. The thing about a plum is they last better in your fruit bowl and you'll get a longer life out of them. So hopefully people go and buy a bit of everything.
Hey, and with summer fruit, you can eat the wrapper.
Yes, you can. And also, they're great for juicing. You know, if everybody's into smoothies these days, plums are fabulous for that.
And if you want to buy some plums and you find that they might be sitting in the fruit bowl for a little bit too long, just run the knife around them, whip the stone out, put them on the tray in the deep freeze. The next day you free flow them, and in no time at all, you've got a plastic bag full of plums for your smoothies for the entire winter.
Or for your plum tart. Yes, there's some fabulous recipes around for anything to do with plums. And they're very easy fruit to use in cakes and all sorts of cooking.
I think it's important that more and more people talk with a plum in their mouth.
Mike and Julie Russell. Interestingly, they don't thin their Black Doris plums because they don't want them to size up too much. The bigger they are, the fewer can fit in a can. The 2% of plums that are exported mainly go to the US.
And Julie's wildflower sculpture exhibition is on this coming November. We'll put a link to a gallery of photos taken in the garden on our webpage, and they'll really make you want to go.
Don't forget we're also on Facebook and on Twitter at RNZ Country.
Bye.
Have a great weekend.